Townie is a new memoir by André Debuse III. It's the story of a boy and his siblings growing up poor in the tough mill towns along the Merrimack River. After their father leaves, Debuse's mother struggles to make a living and hold a family together. André and his siblings skip school, they drink and take drugs, and run from the neighborhood bullies. They live in a bleak and violent world. To survive, André Debuse bulks out and learns to punch harder than anyone who ever punched him. And he does. Townie tells the story of how André Debuse III somehow survived this and went on to become an accomplished writer of books, including The House of Sand and Fog, and make peace with the father who all but abandoned him. And André Debuse III is here to talk about Townie, his new memoir. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Anthony. Good to be here.
It's a beautiful book. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
It really is. Can you describe what the life in your household was like before your father moved out?
It was actually quite lovely the first 4 or 5 years. My parents were very young and in love. My father left the Marines and went to the Outriders workshop, and that's frankly when he was happiest. And they were happiest as a couple in my memory as a little boy. But very soon after that, we moved to the East from Iowa, and my dad got a teaching job at the now-defunct Bradford College in 1966, and their marriage just went south. And so really the house was full of a lot of fighting and yelling and a lot of tears over dead soldiers in Vietnam, and Martin Luther King was killed, and Robert Kennedy was killed, and my family broke up. It's really a year that I associate with good men getting shot in the head and my father leaving.
I wondered if you could read, this is on page 24, it's a passage where you describe your father leaving the family.
Sure. "Daddy!" Nicole ran past us over the gravel, and she leapt, and Pop turned, his eyes welling up, and he caught her, her arms around his neck, her face buried under his chin. I tried to ignore our mother's cries coming from the house. When my father looked down at me over Nicole's small shoulder, I stood as straight as I could, and I hoped I looked strong. Pop kissed Nicole's red hair. He lowered her to the gravel. His beard was thick and dark, his cheeks and throat shaved clean. He was wearing a sweatshirt and corduroy pants, and he glanced up at our house. There was only the sound of our mother's cries, so maybe he would change his mind. Maybe he would stay. He looked down at us. "I'll see you soon. We'll go out to eat." He hugged Suzanne, squeezed my shoulder. He tussled Jeb's hair. Then he was in his car, driving down the hill through the pines, blue exhaust, coughing out its pipe. Jeb scooped up a handful of gravel and ran down the hill after him. "You bum! You bum! You bum!" He threw it all at once, the small rocks scattering across the road and into the woods like shrapnel. Pop drove across the short bridge, then up a rise through more trees. Mom would need to be comforted now. Nicole, too. There was food to think about, how to get it with no car. I tried to keep standing as straight as I could.
It's such a sad passage. There was food to think about, how to get it with no car. I mean, when he left, you and your siblings, things changed so dramatically. And it wasn't that there just wasn't enough money. You really began to live in another world, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, we did. We began to move quite a bit for cheaper rents. The worst year was 3 times in 1 year. And my mother went back to school. She hadn't completed her college work. She got first work as a nurse's aide, then a waitress. And you know, it began a life that many, many millions of people live, which is a life with a single parent in poverty.
Mm. But what was it like, because you were still in touch with your father somewhat?
Yeah.
He visited once a week, took you kids out to the yeah. movies or maybe to get a cheeseburger or something like that. But he was living in he was sort of making his way toward a much different world than
yeah.
you were at that point.
He did have a different life, but I do want to stress it is he was also quite poor. I mean, he really did sometimes just have $10 to last the next 2 weeks. But he lived in a college, either on the college campus where he taught or nearby. It was a fairly idyllic and lovely neighborhood. And we really lived quite differently than he did. We had a much different social milieu. My friends were all blue collar. And, you know, there was a particularly horrible bully in my life when I was about 11 who beat me up just about daily. And my old man came to talk to his father. And I remember watching outside the window of my house, looking at my father and seeing how different he looked than the guys in the neighborhood. He had a trim beard. He was wearing corduroys and loafers. He looked like a professor. And these guys were auto mechanics and unemployed guys and ex-cons. And it felt as if my father had visited us from another planet.
Mm. In the neighborhoods that you grew up in towns like Haverhill and Newburyport, well before Newburyport's transition.
Oh, yeah. Well before it was the little Disney World it is now.
You know, this was the 1960s and 70s. You describe a world that was so violent. As a kid, you were always on the run from neighborhood bullies.
Right.
Where did that violence come from?
I do think, Anthony, that the cruelest people on earth are kids. I think that they can just be horrible to each other. You know, I was the kind of kid who was a target because I was small. I wore glasses. I was a bright kid. I used words like actually and not necessarily. And, you know, I was always the new kid. So I just became a target for cruelty, and I got beat up a lot, as did my brother.
Give me a sense of the violence, and these are in the book. I mean, some of these fights, they aren't just kids kind of jostling each other. I mean, these are kids having their faces smacked in for a long time.
Oh, yeah. You know, one of the things that I find difficult to watch in a lot of American films is violence because it's not done well. Scorsese is the only guy I've seen who does violence well on film. Real violence is not choreographed. It's messy. It's ugly. It's brutal. You know, once a kid's down, there are no rules. You're getting kicked in the head. You're getting kicked in the ribs. Two or three or four are on one kid. I frankly think this kind of violence is how it's been always.
Now, you mentioned that you weren't big, you wore glasses, you weren't sort of courageous, you often froze, you didn't fight back. But tell the story of the moment where you sort of looked at yourself in the mirror and you made a promise that you would learn to fight and you would learn to fight
yeah,
back.
Yeah, I was 14 years old and my brother had been beaten up by a grown man, a 19 or 20-year-old man who'd come home from the Army on leave expressly to beat up my younger brother who was 13. Because my younger brother was playing kissy face with his sister. And he beat him up in front of me, and all I did was plead for him to not beat him up. And, you know, he threatened to beat me up, so I just stood there paralyzed with fear. That was the last straw. I actually looked at my 14-year-old face, and I actually told my face, I don't care if you get killed. You're never going to not fight back again. That very day, I began to exercise. Within a year and a half, I transformed my body, and then I began to fight and fight regularly.
And did that scare you? You got to the point where you could do some pretty serious damage with your fists.
It did start to scare me. It was a strange mixture of emotions. At first, the little boy in me was proud that I'd learned how to throw a punch and take some guy down. At the same time, it began to escalate, as violence does. Violence creates more violence, creates more suffering. In one particular fight that I go into in the book, I'm convinced that if my girlfriend hadn't stepped between me and the young man I was kicking in the head, I may have killed him. I really may have killed him.
And all the while, as I'm reading your book, I'm thinking the real fight here is how Andre Debuse III, the writer, emerges. I mean, talk about breaking boundaries, sort of how he emerges from this world. Your father was a writer, a well-known short story writer. And at one point in the memoir, your mother encourages you to write because she says you're good at it, but you resist. It almost makes you mad.
Yeah, and that moment when my mother actually encouraged me to write, I was actually heading off to get a PhD in Marxist social science at the time, but it had to do with my hatred of all cruelty, including colonialism. That moment with my mother where she suggested I write came not long after my father had written a beautiful story, because all of his stories, in my opinion, are gorgeous and masterful, called Leslie in California, and was based on my sister having been punched in the face by her husband. She lived on the West Coast. We heard about it. You know, we talked about, of course, doing something about it. But he wrote the story, and I thought, this is so useless. Who cares about a story? You know, let's send someone out there to break this guy's bones. Well, how does this help my sister?
And this is in the book. You literally wanted that to happen. Your advice to your dad was, let's hire a guy and have him go over there and break his legs.
Yeah, and cripple him for life, or worse. You know, I'm glad we didn't do that. Violence creates more violence. But, yeah, I rejected literature and the writing of stories out of hand as a useless thing that did nothing for nobody.
So how did that change? At what point did you realize that, like your father, you're a writer too?
So I was training for the Golden Gloves down in Lowell, which sounds fancy, but I didn't actually compete. But I had an AAU number. I was living in Salem, boxing in Lynn. And I was dating a girl who was writing fiction. I began to read fiction for the first time in years. And I felt inspired. So one night, I'm getting ready to run to the boys' club in Lynn where I boxed to train. And instead, in an almost trance-like state to this day, which still surprises me, I found myself brewing tea and sitting down to write a scene instead. I still do not know how that came to be. I had no intention to do that. I just did it. And shortly thereafter, I finished writing my first short story, and it wasn't a good story, but when I finished it, I really felt like Andre for the first time in my life. And I still didn't want to be a writer, but I thought I needed to keep doing this writing thing just to feel like me.
Let me come back to your father. Your memoir paints a picture of someone who really neglected his kids. He didn't just leave a marriage. He really left you kids high and dry in very serious ways. Did he appreciate or acknowledge that?
This may surprise you, but I am surprised at people's reaction to my father's portrait in the book. I actually, when I wrote this, had no score to settle with him at all. I felt no anger writing this. I was just trying to capture what it was like to be the boy. And what came up was his absence. I wrestled with how much I was going to allow that into the book because I don't want to, you know, betray my dead father or paint him in a way from which he can't defend himself. But the truth is he was not there. And the way a lot of divorced fathers weren't in the 70s, we never slept at his house. We didn't have split custody. We saw him 2 hours on Sunday, and that was it. No phone calls in between. So that you really can't say that he raised us. Our mother raised us. Mm. But here, I have to say this too, and hopefully this is in the book. I truly believe that people do the best they know how to do. I don't think it's usually the best we can do, because most of us can do better. But I'm convinced my father, in his own way, given his own demons and his own upbringing, did the best he knew how to do with us. You know, looking back, you know, he could have done better, but I think he did the best he knew how.
Well, Andre Debuse, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
That's Andre Debuse III. His new memoir is called Townie. And Andre Debuse will be reading and discussing his memoir with author Richard Russo tomorrow night at 6 at the Brattle Theater. You can find more information and read an excerpt from Townie on our website, radioboston.org.
Tomorrow on Radio Boston, do unions need better PR? The contentious labor battle in Wisconsin has prompted unions from California to Massachusetts to rally for public support, but are they winning hearts and minds of average Americans? That's tomorrow on Radio Boston.
And Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us tomorrow for more Radio Boston.